You don't need a business coach. You don't need a business mentor even. You just need a friend that you can go down to the pub with and talk about business. I do believe when you've got a good idea for a product or service, you should pitch it to at least 20 or 30 people before you even start to jump to any conclusions as to whether it's a good idea or not. It's one of the best things about like running a business. You can literally make money from nothing. You know, a lot of people, if they just remembered that, they would start so much sooner.
Hello and welcome to the Show Your Value podcast, where we explore the art of value creation in three macro buckets: material value creation, emotional energy value creation, and spiritual value creation. Today, my very special guest is Robin Waite. Robin is the founder of Fearless Business, a regular speaker at various business events, and best-selling author of several books, including Online Business Startup, Marketing Machine, and the recent popular release, Take Your Shot. Robin uses his two decades of business experience to coach clients to reach their goals, create more time, and increase their revenue. At age 18, Robin spent 4 years as a systems analyst for a medical devices company, increasing their turnover by 50%. Incredible. From 2004 to 2016, Robin led a successful marketing agency serving over 250 clients. During this time, delivering workshops, masterclasses, that helped over 1,000 business owners improve their marketing, product architecture, pricing, websites, and digital advertising. Robin, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Lee. Looking forward to getting stuck into this.
Yeah, and to kind of get this started, I do feel like we're on very similar missions here. And at the end of Take Your Shot, which I read in the last couple of days getting ready for this conversation, you want to help 10,000 businesses double the revenue in the next 5 years. So you figured out a way to kind of scale this. And for me, you know, anybody that can create a job is a hero of mine. It's one more person that can support their families and causes that really matter in the world. Give us a little bit of history to where you developed this drive to help early stage businesses, but even people thinking about starting a business.
Yeah, great question to start with. You touched on it in the intro, actually. When I spent 4 years working as a systems analyst, the guy who was in charge of that business was, and you probably see this all the time as well with a lot of the people you work with, but he was a real innovator. He was absolutely fantastic at like creating these brilliant products for the business, but he was a terrible business owner. And so I didn't really understand that much about business in the, you know, as a teenager sort of going into my first job. But that was a very good indoctrination into how not to run a business. And I decided if ever I started a business up, then I would make sure that I wouldn't do it the way that he did. I'd focus much more heavily on making sure that one, that business was profitable and sustainable, and also helping other people to make sure that their businesses were profitable and sustainable in the process as well. The rest, as they say, is history. I mean, I couldn't believe it the other day. I registered my first limited company in February 2004. So I've been in business now, business owner for 20 plus years, and that time has absolutely flown by. But yeah, as a result of that and those formative years, that's driven me to help more people and do it at a bigger scale and create more impact.
That's great. And where are you located for our listeners?
Yeah, based in England, so down in the southwest of the UK. There's a city called Bristol. So if people want to go and check it out on the map, that's where I'm based.
Okay, that's great. And you're helping business owners in service based businesses all over the world, or primarily Europe. Where are you focused? Where are your clients?
Yeah, so initially when I first started coaching, so that was about 2016, I was doing a lot of very local sort of networking. So started in sort of Gloucestershire, which is the county, the region where I'm based. And then very slowly it's expanded. But we've now got clients in about 20 countries worldwide, ranging from Shanghai and Hong Kong, just taken on our first client from Australia, which is interesting, managing sort of the time zone differences there, because literally the other side of the world for us. Clients in North America, South America, Brazil, Canada, and multiple countries all across Europe. And we've even got a client down in South Africa as well, which is good fun too. Very different culture, which they work with business-wise down there generally. But yeah, I think we're in about 20 countries now.
That's fantastic. Spread the value creation all around the world and keep going. So As I'm going through your work, I get this picture of stages, and this is a little bit how I think about it, but I'm getting it from your work as well. There's sort of stage one, the idea, stage two, does the market want it? Like, go prove it. Not somebody else did it, but can you prove it? And then stage three, packaging it, stage four, scaling it. And there's a stage zero that comes out a lot in your work that I'm finding, which is mindset. How do you think about it? Do you believe in yourself? You know, all of that. Talk about the importance of that, because that feels like by far the most important piece if I'm thinking about starting a business.
Yeah, well, not just starting, Lee. It's all the different stages of running a business, like mindset comes into it. And what's interesting, so because of the nature of the work which I do, I get exposed to a lot of what I class as like true startups. So they're literally, they've got an idea, or mum said, oh, you're really good at doing this, you should go off and start a business doing it. So they haven't developed any of the things which you said, their answer or price or their understanding who their ideal client is, or even what the offer is. But yet they come in with preconceived ideas about what it takes to start and run a business. And it's often those ideas, especially around like perfection, is something which I see an awful lot. So they want to, somebody wants to start a business will often think, oh, I've got to get a website set up and I've got to get my branding done and it's got to look just right. And the product, I can't launch it yet because it's not quite ready. So they're already kind of, you know, putting these barriers up in front of them before they've even gone out and started speaking to people about their idea. And I'd say out of all of the things which stop people, the biggest one is money. So too many, I don't know where people have got this idea from. Maybe it's from sort of programs like Shark Tank and Dragon's Den, where you see people getting investment, you know, for to start and grow their business. And I think a lot of people have this preconceived ideas that it costs a lot of money to start a business. And even where there are businesses where you need some kind of capital to start it up. So take a gardening business, for example. Yes, eventually you might need to buy a lawnmower and a hedge trimmer. And we were talking about that, funny enough, before we started recording. My neighbor's trimming his hedges, you know. So you've got to buy the equipment. But actually the reality is, no, you don't. Because most people who own a house who have a lawn, they already have a lawnmower probably in their shed, or they already have a hedge trimmer stowed away somewhere. So you go around and knock on 50 doors and you speak to them and say, hey, listen, I'm a gardener. We're taking on clients in your area. We've got a wait list at the moment. So we're looking at starting in, say, you know, a month's time or 2 months' time. So you can start to build up, first of all, a wait list. And then when somebody says, okay, well, when, you know, what happens? How do you start? Well, what we typically like to do is, because we know that you like your lawn mowed in a certain way and you have your own equipment, we tend to use our clients' equipment. So you can literally start from nothing. You can knock on some doors and just make it, if you just remain a humble human being, and don't expect to like go out and make millions from day one, you know, going out and knocking on 20 doors and getting a day's worth of work for $100, say, is a start. That's how businesses start. They start green and lean. And then slowly over time, you start to raise your prices a bit. You get better at being able to articulate the value around what you do. The results, i.e. the results of you know, you going out and doing somebody's garden, like getting the person excited about why they should hire you as their gardener, for example. So you can raise your rates and then you can start to invest into the business. Then you can invest some of that into a website. Then you can invest some of it into maybe getting some machinery and some equipment. Maybe you can invest in somebody to help you with your branding, for example, and maybe getting, you know, a van sign written or, you know, a magnetic sign put on it. So you can literally, it's one of the best things about like running a business. You can literally make money from nothing. And I think, you know, a lot of people, if they just remembered that, they would start so much sooner.
Yeah. And do you think, because a lot of it's excuses that I hear as well, I can't start because of this, I need money, or all these things have to be in place, or here's the thing, and I know what step 15 looks like, and I need to have all that ready before I even begin. I feel like a lot of times those are excuses to kind of cover up a fear of failing. Like, what happens if it doesn't work? Or is it just such a big problem in their brain they can't connect the dots? But I feel like it's more a fear of failing rather than just getting started. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's like anything, isn't it? If you don't know what's out there, like what to expect, naturally it's going to elicit some kind of fear. And so I liken it to, or a good analogy which I use in those circumstances, Lee, is around like when you're driving your car, and it's night, nighttime, your headlights only light up 50 meters or 100 meters of the road in front of you. Yet for whatever reason, you continue to carry on driving, don't you? And because we have this, we trust that the road is going to carry on being there. You know, once the light ends, the road is still going to be there, right? The challenge is, though, with something like starting up a business, most people have never had any experience of running a business. And so the road, the map, doesn't even exist. They can't even comprehend like what's out there beyond, you know, the headlights, you know, and it going dark, for example. So, it's pervasive. It goes right the way through, not just in startup land, but I see very experienced business owners still, they have this fear, which is floating around, and fear shows up in business in all sorts of different ways, or the things which people are afraid of. I had a conversation with a guy whose net worth was like 600 million, and he was afraid that it was just going to disappear, like evaporate overnight. And you think when you've got that level of capital and like income, money behind you and assets, you'd have thought, oh, why should that guy be afraid? But he was, $600 million of assets, and yet he still had that fear. And Lee, I can guarantee as well, like I have them. I've got no shame in admitting this, but I bet, Lee, there's something which you've kind of been thinking about launching, or thinking about a new service or a product which you want to take out there into the market, or maybe an add-on for your existing clients, where even you are kind of like, oh, I'm not sure whether your confidence isn't there, like, right, I'm just going to go for it. You kind of mull it over and you think about it and you build a plan, and you know, and then one day you go, right, I'm going to go for it.
Yeah, and it totally agree. I'm actually on my seventh company. I've started from scratch. I'm starting another one in a couple of months. It's not about the number of companies, it's about the value that I want to create in the world. And you talk a lot about this in your work, and I've watched podcasts where you're sort of, you know, coaching folks through the process. I've learned to trust the process. And if it's unknown, you know, might feel a little uncomfortable going forward. I just know if I do the work, like start driving the car, and I love that metaphor, even if the lights aren't working, I'm out walking alongside the car, feeling the road while I'm tinkering with the lights to get them to work. I mean, I've just learned to keep moving, and the process works 100% of the time. So do we have uncertainty? Is it fear? You know, for me, I'm not sure that's the case at all anymore. It's, am I willing to put in the work to actually do it? And so to me, this gets to and there's stuff that I'm launching, content, another service that I'll or product essentially that I'll talk about here in a bit. But for me, it's, are you really creating value in the world? Like if you're going to start a business, or you have a business and you want to scale it, you have to do the work and really genuinely be interested in creating value, not just getting a check. And I think in the culture globally today, in a lot of ways, it's, how do I get money quickly? Because people are talking about that. It's all about the money, and it can't be just that. If you don't have the emotional energy side right, you don't have the spiritual side right, in my opinion, it's just not going to work. You can't sustain it, you know, long term. But if you can't talk about doing the work to create genuine value, as opposed to making it only the material value creation piece, which is an important thing to cultivate, but if it's only that, it falls apart.
Yeah, absolutely. You've touched on something really interesting there. So, but equally, Lee, that's what gives you and I the unfair advantage. And any business owners out there who are like, they find something that they're deeply passionate about and they're really committed to, all of those business owners that find those things are going to, that's their unfair advantage. It means that they're going to stay the course. They're going to last for like infinitely longer than anybody else. That's why Simon Sinek talks about the infinite game, right? You know, most people, when they're stepping out and just doing it just for the money, they're seeing this thing as like win or lose. A game where they are either going to go out and make loads of money, or they're not going to make any money and pivot and go off and do something different. Whereas I say the best businesses tend to, they realize that the game is about staying in the game for as long as you possibly can do when it comes to business. You know, you probably see it all the time. You see through people where they're just doing it for the money, and next week they're doing something different, and next week they're trying something different. They're I call them the career chameleons, basically. Every 5 minutes they're changing their colors to, you know, whatever the next fad is. But there's a reason why you've set up 7 businesses and been able to stay the course. I'd be curious, actually, because it's hard enough running one business, right, Lee? But how do you sustain running 7 businesses, for example? What's your secret?
Yeah, well, I've had exits from a few $1 million to well into 9 figures. So I'm not running all of them, but I'm working with a lot of clients where I'm invested in their businesses, but I don't count them as mine. And I think that's just how you set up the structure, right? You know, why is it that there are folks that work 80 hours a week trying to run a $300,000 or $400,000, you know, $1,000 business a year, barely make it, constantly on the edge of going out of business, and other folks that are running multiple $1 billion plus businesses, and they seem to have all the free time in the world? So, you know, for me, it's about outcome, structure, people. Are they, you know, is your team owning the outcomes? Is every team member acting like the CEO of their own role and having fun and really driving, you know, the productive emotional energy to make that happen? And we as leaders create that environment, but it's kind of down the road, right? So I've gone through all these evolutions. I remember my first year when I bought, I'll call it my first real business, because my first business was actually playing guitar and singing in a rock and roll band in the 1980s, played over 1,000 in clubs, concerts. That's how I made most of my money. But early 90s, my first real business, I assumed the company for its debt. It was about $600,000. The first year, I mean, we had to have facilities. We had to buy materials. I mean, this wasn't a service business. It was a service, but a lot of, you know, products, chemicals, and things that we had to buy to make it happen. Did $360,000 in sales, almost went out of business 15 times. Our capital equipment budget was $175. So, oh my gosh. And my mindset back then was I can see $1 million company. And then after the first year, I could see 5 million. After the third year, I could easily see 10. And then this one went to about 100 million before we sold it. But it's trusting that, you know what, this kind of sucks right now. And this is really hard, but I still have this warm feeling inside. When I solve for this, this is my healthy struggle as a business leader, I'm going to be able to create so much value coming out the other side, and I won't struggle with this again when I solve for it. So it kind of goes back to how do you get people to trust the struggle? Because in reading your work, listening to your interviews, you're about walking them through that. I mean, that's what I really loved about Take Your Shot. You're going through this journey. It's a golf pro example of starting a business, but you really connect with what it feels like to start, the fears, the conditions. I'm working way too much. I'm not home with my family. Like, this is so normal. And then you walk through the process of what it feels like to organize it in a way, you know, if you will, go from sort of calm to, or see chaos to calm, in a believable way, like you've really connected there. And so for our listeners, you know, how do they think about managing expectations as in terms of what will happen? It's going to feel so different as they go through it, but how do they stick with that process? I mean, how do you get them there? Obviously, I mean, I've seen that. But how do you think about that?
Well, it's very clichedly, actually, but 1 + 1 = 3. I think the moment you add in that second person into the mix, it's like when Russ meets the business coach out on the golf course and starts to get help. So he asks for help, and then he's accepting and listens to that help, that advice which he's receiving, and then starts to implement it. Like so many business owners struggle, you know. I mean, there's a stat which I find quite amusing, because a lot of people just, they have no idea about this. But in the UK, for example, we have 6 million registered businesses in 2024. And if I asked you, Lee, to hesitate a guess towards how many of those would be defined as a large business, how many would you say out of the 6 million businesses?
Well, I'm not sure what the definition of large is, but it's really small. I mean, it's probably less than 2 or 3%.
Yeah, pretty much bang on, actually. So there's slightly less than that, but there's 30,000 registered businesses that are classified as large in the UK out of 6 million. So it's a tiny proportion, which means that a vast majority of business, and the definition is 250 or more employees. So obviously there's it's that typical sort of J curve where the minority are kind of at one end of the tiny minority are at one end of the spectrum, making up a vast proportion of the businesses with hires. But as you go down through the scale, like when people say to me, "Oh, what's your niche?" I ask them what their niche is, and they say SME, small medium enterprise. I'm like, well, that's not a niche. That's all of the businesses, because you know they all fit outside those 30,000 large businesses. So when a majority of the businesses are small one person businesses, which actually accounts for close to 86% of businesses registered in the UK are just small one person businesses. It shows you that a lot of people are just trying to do this on their own. And is it any wonder that they hit a stumbling block when they're not earning as much money as they want to be earning? So they've got nothing to reinvest back into their business or themselves, that they then go, oh, this business thing isn't working. And so they go back to gainful employment, you know. And it's a real shame, because there's some brilliant like people out there, brilliant, if they just had a little bit of guidance and a little bit of steering in the right sort of direction, or even just I always say as well, I do myself out of a job. You don't need a business coach, you don't need a business mentor even. You just need a friend that you can go down to the pub with and talk about business. It could be one of the mums or dads from school. It could be an uncle who runs their own like corner shop. It could be any number of different people. But just go and sit with somebody who talks about business, is enthused by business, has ideas about business. And even something, you know, like going, you've obviously listened to Take Your Shot to the book, but listen to audiobooks, listen to podcasts, listen to YouTube videos. These are all great ways to learn about business. And the moment you start realizing you can't do it all on your own, and you start taking on advice from other people and trying out different things, it's like businesses scale so quickly, because people just start trying out. First of all, they realize that, well, the goal isn't to win everything. So stuff, you're going to try stuff and it's going to fail or not work. But you can learn from that and then grow your knowledge and grow your business as a result of it. But 1 + 1 definitely equals 3. And I noticed, Lee, one of the things which you said when I asked you that question about your businesses was it was I when it wasn't going very well, but it was we when everything was going really well. I don't know if you noticed that.
But that's the truth. Yeah. Right. That's I think I hear leaders complain about team members and this didn't work, that didn't work, and they've taken a bunch of investment money and like, wait a minute, you made all of those decisions. When it does work, we did it together, you played your part, but when it doesn't work, it really is mostly on the top leader. You know, I see leaders that are expecting people to get a result. They didn't describe what the result is, and they didn't even prove they had something that had scalable traction. So even if they're capable, it's something that the market doesn't want. And so, yeah, I mean, that's where I come from. I could go on for days about this particular, you know, topic, but it is, we're the ones designing it, making sure the right pieces are in place. Eventually, the team's doing a lot of that, and eventually they're doing all of it on its own. It's scaling without us, right? Depending where you want to go. The upfront piece, like, how do I start? How do I think about it? I love the way you talk about the three F's, freedom, fulfillment, and finance, as a way to get your head around what the ideal place to start is. Talk about that.
Yeah. One of the things which I've observed about a lot of my clients, especially before I start working with them, and then you sort of start to piece things together and look to the wider community as well. But specifically the Fearless Grower, notice that they're incredibly like bright people and they get amazing results for their clients. Yet, and a lot of my clients as well, they've come from a job into starting up a business. But inevitably what tends to happen is they're kind of underselling themselves, because they kind of charge out the way that they think they should be charging, which is really similar to like how a job would be charged out, or like an hourly rate effectively, or an effective hourly rate. So they're busy doing, working all hours under the sun, but they're not getting as well compensated for it, you know. And essentially what they've done is created a job for themselves. Very cliche. There's lots of people who kind of talk about this. But it doesn't correlate when you've got these smart people and all they've done is managed to create a job for themselves, because smart people you would have thought would be sort of more innovative. But, and so you then start to unpack what's going on in that story for all, because it's so common. It happens to so many business owners when they start out. You start to unpack it all and you start to realize that the bit they found fun. So you're probably familiar with the E-Myth, I would imagine. which is a fantastic book, where he talks about the technician. And so when somebody comes out of a job and goes into their business, they think the thing which is going to make them money is the technician's role. So all they start doing is doing more and more of being the technician day in and day out of their business. And part of the reason they do that is because they enjoy their work. They enjoyed that technician's role. So it kind of makes sense that they would carry on doing more of that in their own business. But the challenge is, when you're working in a job, there's Gary over there who does, you know, heads up sales. There's Tracy over there who heads up accounts. There's, you know, so you've got these different people doing different roles. In your own business, now all of a sudden you've got to put all of these different hats on alongside the technician. And what, you know, and what inevitably happens as well is, like, marketing in 2024, I hate to say it, is like really, it's so confusing for, on so many different levels when you first start out in a business. Like, and I know this because my first business in 2004 was a marketing agency. We built websites, we did branding and things like that. Social media wasn't really a thing. Like, Facebook didn't kick into action until 2003, like a year before I started that up that business, and wasn't mainstream for another however many, 7 or 8 years after that, certainly here over in the UK anyway. And then you take into consideration sort of LinkedIn and YouTube and all these different platforms that have come in to play over the last 20 years. Now there couldn't be a better time to start a business, but there also couldn't be a worse, more confusing time to start a business with all the technology we've got, you know, right? But going back to it though, so now we've got these business owners who all they want to do is the fun bit of their job, which is the technician's work. Now they've got to do marketing, sales, accounts, and all the admin and all the different things in their business that they didn't, that's not why they set up a business in the first place. So now the fun's kind of taken out of it, which naturally starts to erode, you know, the fulfilling side of it. And certainly the freedom gets eroded because they, you know, they spend 2 or 3 days doing the technician's work and then probably 2 or 3, 4 or 5 more days doing all of the peripheral stuff, you know. So the freedom's now gone as well. And because they're doing so little of the technician's work, the client fulfillment work, well, they're not actually getting paid commensurate amounts of money either because they just don't have the capacity to be able to do it. So the challenge is, though, they approach it in the wrong way to fix that problem because they go, oh, well, in order to make more money, I'll find more clients to do work with. But that's the thing that got them into that problem in the first place, doing the technician's job, right? So my job is then just to start to unpick all of that and start to figure out, well, in that technician's role, and you can look at the likes of, you know, Perry Marshall, who's a brilliant consultant. You know, he talks about 80-20ing the business, where you figure out what are the 20% of the things that you're doing that contribute towards 80% of the outputs, and let's focus on those. So that's my job, is to pick out the 20%, or sometimes even we go further than that, the 20%, the 4%, the 20% of the 20%, to figure out where the real gold is. And then we can package it up into something that's really valuable.
Yeah, one of the key things that's standing out to me in this part of the discussion is, don't start down the road of a business that doesn't fill your cup, you know, that you're not excited about. So figure that out. And then the whole part about creating value. So that's kind of my world. And really, that's my mission, is how do I connect culture to value creation within organizations? But how about on the planet? Like, let's go after everybody trying to create more value than they consume. And so as you get into this and you think about pricing for value, a universal pricing policy that I love is to charge the highest possible price while being the best value alternative and encouraging future business. And so that's the whole game, creating value in the world. And when you do that, you're getting paid for the relative value, you know, you're sort of creating for somebody else. And so thinking this way is really important. And you brought this up in the book, you know, sort of an example, and you know, also from some of the podcasts that I listened to, that the focus has to be on what's the return for the client. Like, what are they looking for? What's the return? How do we need to solve for that? And there's nothing more important, in my opinion, if you're going to start a relationship. If not, you're just looking for a check, and that's not good. Talk about that a little bit. That's so important, and most actually miss that concept.
Yeah, I mean, most people get sort of bogged down in terms of like selling features effectively, because that's what, again, you think about the technician, that's what they know inside and out, and they've probably done it for years, and that's what they've trained to do all of these years. So It's a bit like if you were going out to sell cars, for example. Well, trying to sell it by getting people excited about the number of wheels that are on a car, or whether it's got a carburetor or not, or what the CC of the, you know, the turbo or the induction, you know, all of those things. Whereas actually the reality of what it comes down to is most people, when they're buying a car, what they're most concerned about is when they get in it and put the accelerator down for the first time, how it's going to make them feel. And ultimately, that's the value proposition that you've got to, business owners need to try and extrapolate out of their, you know, what out of their potential, their prospects, their clients, like what's going to put the biggest smile on their face when they say yes to working with you. You know, I'd be curious actually about, we'll see whether this works or not, but the business which you're kind of just starting up, what, tell us a bit about that, because it might be, we could explore what the value proper, you probably already know it, Lee, because you're an experienced business owner, but it might be helpful to kind of go through the process together to help the listeners kind of understand what the value proposition is in your new business.
Yeah. So what I've done, I won't talk about the one starting in a couple of months, but I'll talk about a new service in the last couple of years that I've been proving has scalable traction. And then let's get this thing started. So I have a consulting business as well. I work with any, companies from startups, just an idea, all the way to $60 billion plus market cap companies, helping them execute strategy. I love all of it. It doesn't matter where I'm at. It's a team trying to create value. Same people, same human nature, all of it. It's amazing. I wrote a book, and I want to get into marketing assets versus marketing activity here in a bit. And one of the things I realized is that how do we get CEOs together in mastermind groups where it really accelerates the value of their organization? So I started something called Execute Masterminds. And I started, I've been part of masterminds for over 40 years with overlap. And this started probably 3.5 years ago. I experimented. I said, I know there's a significantly better way to where you can get 80% plus of the brain power in the room to help each of the members. And this is going to just go to the moon in terms of the results that we get. So experimented, starting 3.5 years ago. This works. I very quickly built 3 groups. I limit it to 8. So every 2 months, we do a deep dive in everybody's business. We know what the most important number is for each business that describes the value of it and drives the majority of the right behaviors. We keep the CEOs at the critical point where they need to be in their organization to create the most value next. And they realize that their job as a CEO is to continually increase the value of the organization by proxy their team, their senior team. That's their job as well. And with this, having this group, we'll just get significantly better results, because I believe in most of the other groups, the community is great. I mean, meeting people, being around, it's so important. But because you know so little about each other's business, when they bring up an issue, it's usually a symptom of something going on, but you don't know. So you just address that thing. And some of the groups grow to 16 or more people. So you get to talk about your stuff maybe once every year and a half. So this is different, results that are typical in the first year, 40% is the minimum growth and profitability. Had one in the first year go 1,100% up, and we're metaphorically looking at all the companies in the group like it's, we've invested our retirement money here in this conglomerate. We want a really good return. So it's going really well. Now I want to scale it through chairs. I've been interviewing chairs that can meet our criteria and go from there. But when I think about the, 10 years down the road, because you talk about 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 years, and how you think about the goals, if I want to make a difference in connecting culture to value creation, what if I have 1,000 or more chairs around the world that have 3 or 4 groups apiece? This will make a dent in making that happen, and it'll be a better world for you and I and our families to interact with. So there's the foundation. What do you think?
So here's where you can, there's 2 really clear ways to kind of delineate the value proposition for something like that. So the first one would be the old way of like feature selling. So remember just talking about what people are going to get when they get together in a mastermind. Okay. So let's say, for example, it sounded like it's a physical meetup, right? So, if we sold it by virtue of like, hey, we're going to meet in, a local boutique hotel and we're going to spend the day together. There's a nice lunch. And you're going to get to do a bit of networking with some other business owners, right? That, that's And that's like, that's selling the wheels, the carburetor, the features of the car, basically. The types of business owner that you might attract to that, that might sound appealing to, I don't know, a business owner doing maybe 100K, 200K or something like that. Haven't really got a team. The types of deals which they do are maybe quite small. So it's kind of like playing it quite safe, small, whatever. But if all of a sudden the value proposition, I know this is like, this is probably rushing the process slightly, but hopefully it will give people an idea to see the two sides of this. If you position it of those things are just like, that's just a given. You get that in any mastermind group. That's not really a USP. But what's different about us is we only work with eight-figure CEOs, and the average deal size when people get in the room together using our process and meeting the people that we put together is worth $1 million. All of a sudden, you can see that people might spend, I don't know, $5,000 for the version where it's just selling features, but would they spend $50,000 a year to be a member of this elite mastermind for, you know, high net worth business owners who are doing proper business, big deals in the room, right? You can see the difference there between the value of each of those. Not to say that like either of them is, you know, just because this one over here where we're selling features and for smaller businesses, it doesn't devalue it because there is still an audience for that. But if you want to build something of significant value, you've got to have pitch a completely different value proposition. And another good example of this, I did some work a couple of years ago with a divorce coach. So she realized actually her secret sauce wasn't about helping people to divorce. It was actually keeping them together, believe it or not. Because she started out life as a divorce lawyer, kind of just doing, you know, the where we're tearing up the contract piece. That was her kind of bread and butter for a long period of time. But she used to work with a lot of high net worth individuals, and money was obviously a major issue when it comes to divorce. So, you know, and the average divorce for the type of client she was working with ended up being like $2.2 million or something just on her fees alone. So she was like, and it was, you know, massively dividing families. And she also saw that there was some families that would rather just stick together. They just couldn't find a way through it. So she pivoted. She went out and retrained as a coach. She started helping people to stay together. Her value proposition was based on, well, if I can't help you stay together, I'll help you move apart. And she would then, she kind of set, you know, ethically, she managed to split the two businesses off so she could do both. So she used to charge £250,000 for a 12-month coach. Sorry, dollars, $250,000 for a 12-month program to help the couple stay together. You know, which is a massive saving for some of those families. But when you start to break down, like, and most ordinary people probably couldn't afford $250K on a coaching program, for example, or certainly wouldn't see the value of it. But if you start to break it down and pick it apart, well, She's a brilliant coach, very effective coach, very effective at what she does. But if she coached a newlywed couple and charged a tenth of the price, say $25,000, well, they wouldn't see the value even at a tenth of the price. They're newlyweds. Why would they even be thinking about divorce, right? And you could go another step further. You could divide it by another 10 times. And at $2,500, she could be coaching a single guy in his 20s. Well, he's not even married yet. Why would he even be thinking about divorce? So $2,500 isn't even of any value to him at all. So he wouldn't spend that, irrespective of how good a coach he was. And I think a lot of business owners don't stop to think about the outcome which they're delivering for their clients. They look at it very much from their own perspective of, well, how much would I pay for something? Do I actually need this thing? And then they also listen to the wrong evidence as well. So when they do finally take it out to the market, you know, the first person that they speak to says, oh, no, I wouldn't pay that for it. And of course, they believe them, right? But there's more of a narrative behind this as well. When that person says no, it's because they don't get the value. They don't understand the value, or maybe the value, it's just not relevant. That product just isn't relevant to them, right? And that is also just a straw poll of one person. And I do believe when you've got a good idea for a product or service, you should pitch it to at least 20 or 30 people before you even start to jump to any conclusions as to whether it's a good idea or not. And I think a lot of people, they listen to the wrong advice. They listen to the wrong person, i.e. the first person who says no, who doesn't understand what results to expect or what experience they're going to get when they say yes to working with you, or what process you're going to take them through, or just anything about it, so that they're the wrong person to listen to. You kind of need a good amount of like statistical significance, a good number of amount of data before you make conclusions about whether, you know, what the true value is within the product you're delivering, and adapt that message as you go.
Yeah. There's so much in what you just went through, and it's, in my view, again, it goes back to it's a normal, healthy struggle to get to a place where you have all that and you can scale. Like, how do you go to a client and say, hey, I'm going to create all this for you. And they say, well, give me four other people that have used it for the last 3 years and how it worked out for them. And you don't have any because you just started. You still have to muscle through that and struggle through it. And there's always a way to do it. In our case, I've got a lot of great things going on. This is a new offering. Work directly with clients, hundreds and hundreds of them. My team is fantastic. But I think this can have the biggest impact on the world. And I describe it as full contact value creation. And when they come in, we're going to significantly increase the value of the organization, have to look for the right persona mindset to come in, she or he that are running, you know, whatever. They have to realize that they grow personally, professionally, in their ability to create more value by leaning in to help others do it. I like the diversity in the groups. It's from $1 million to hundreds of millions of dollars. And there's so much value in going both ways and how the conversation goes. But that's really what we're selling. And I already have examples. I think the best one is a company worth about $1 million, I think 1.2 when he started. 21 months later, now it's worth $46 million. And it's just one after another like this. Like, well, and it's a little unfair because I know this works. I've been doing this for a long time. I even had Jack Welch, former CEO of General Electric, who passed not too long ago, was a business partner with me and my company, ETW. And he told me what I had was the best business management system he'd ever seen. So I know this works. Lots of smart people have looked at it. Now I'm just trying to do it at scale. And so now I have to package and test. How do I find chairs that won't screw up our brand, that'll do the right work, right? I mean, it's holistic, very nuanced consulting in the room when you're facilitating groups like this. It's not the easiest thing in the world to do. I guess as you would be amazing at it. But yeah, I love how you're thinking about all of this. I think there's a ton of value here for our listeners. You know, one of the things we touched on a little bit earlier, if you could talk about, is managing expectations for the first year or two. For example, I had a friend say that she wanted to get into being a residential real estate agent. Great. What do you think that process is going to look like? So you had to go through, pass the tests and all of it. And we came up with, you know what? It'll take about 6 months before a deal happens and about 12 months before there's enough deal flow going on, because you have to build community to where this makes sense. And she was like, okay, this is it. Let's do it. And for the first 6 months, there literally was nothing. And it was probably five and a half months, got the first deal, but crying, wanting to give up all of it. At the end of a year, it was, wow, it's actually enough flow. At the end of 4 years, it was $30,000 a month in income being a residential realist, because she did all the work. But without me as a friend, confidant, talking about this on a regular basis, she probably would have given up. So there's two things here. It's, how do you help people manage expectation? Because it usually feels way worse than what you already decided intellectually it's going to feel like the first year or two. And then see the value of coaching. Some just don't see the value.
Yeah. So interestingly, actually, Lee, so I have a friend of mine. So he's an associate coach on my program now. It's a really lovely guy. So originally I mentored him in his business. So he's a hospitality consultant. So, and he's one of those people that just applied the principles, did a fantastic job. And I was like, I need to keep you close because you've just listened, you've applied it, you get it. So, when you find people like that, keep them. But of course, in hospitality and COVID, it's, you know, went downhill very quickly, especially here in the UK. Literally, we were locked down for 5 months. Nowhere was open. You couldn't go anywhere. So that, and his business was predicated on that. So he actually pivoted. He went into real estate himself and bought a local franchise, and went through that very difficult first 6 months where it was just, you know, building up the pipeline of work and getting the contacts in the local area. So I hear you, especially with your client and the journey which they had to go on. How he got through that was quite interesting though. So a lot of people, and I think this is what, again, there's things we hear about a lot in business that I think, again, sometimes you kind of don't always want to assume that they apply to your business, or maybe in the way that it's necessarily explained to you. So take, for example, one way of setting goals is SMART goals, right? That's bandied around a lot in business. But the trouble is, I see it break a lot of business owners because they set these specific, measurable, actionable, realistic, you know, time-bound goals. That's, you know, SMART goals. And then they don't hit them and they end up being really disappointed. And that when it gets to that point of like, and they can't, or they reach a certain point, they can see they're going to miss those targets and their motivation starts to dip. And I think there's actually a smarter way to do it than SMART goals. So you quoted something actually, which I said on Ali Abdaal's podcast, when I was a guest on there. So Ali's written a book called Feel Good Productivity. And he talks about, rather than SMART goals, nice goals, right? And that stands for something which is, I'm going to get it out actually, because I won't do it justice unless I quote it exactly. And I was reading it, reviewing it again this morning. So NICE stands for near term. So all smart goals are way off, they're out in the distance, right? It's hard to kind of, as human beings, we only think about 3 weeks in advance. Some women, very organized, they think a long way in advance, my wife being one of those. Me, I'm much more short term in my thinking. So near term works quite nicely for me. Input based. So we know specifically what inputs we're going to do. Cause again, SMART goals are all about outputs, which actually, and this is what the C is in NICE, controllable. SMART goals, a lot of the time, rely on things that are just massively out of our control. So they just don't work, because we can do all of the stuff, but we might miss our goal because something else happened that's entirely out of our control. And then the last one I love, I mean, it's Feel Good Productivity. So it's the book there, if anybody's watching the video. But energizing. So we need to do work which fills us up with energy, right? So in this example, what I worked on with my friend was we focused on a lot of things that were in his control and near term. Could he get 1,000 leaflets printed off and then over the course of the first couple of weeks, go out and deliver 100 leaflets a day in the local area? Because that's all within his control. He can see that he's gone out and he's done that over the course of a couple of weeks, delivered 1,000 leaflets. What was interesting, when his business started to take off, he didn't stop delivering the leaflets. So when he goes out and does a viewing with a house or an inspection, he takes a box of leaflets with him and he'll go and leaflet the postcode, the zip code, right? So he'll go and do 100 or 200 houses whilst he's out and about anyway. So the muscle memory you build through these near-term goals, which aren't financially driven, because we don't know immediately that it's going to bring us money back in. But if we can build them in as part of our daily ritual, our habits. And so even when our business is firing, these things that probably, there's been business owners where I've had discussions with them about, we'll just go and deliver a load of flyers. And they think that like flyering is beneath them somehow. You're never going to cut it in business if you're not willing to do like just the basics, just the simple things. And I even told that person, don't bother running a business. If you can't be bothered to go out and like fly or drop your local area for your business, you're not going to cut it if you can't be prepared to do those things, right? And it's like the simple stuff like that we can be doing like now, right away, that makes the biggest difference, because over time, gradually it compounds and we start to go through that. Something which you said as well, Lee, which I loved, was that getting comfortable with the fact is hard work to begin with. But if you can get through that discomfort, you can turn it around then into doing something which you start to enjoy, right? How I break this down for my clients, I just one very simple example. And I don't care if people think that this is a bit naff, right? Every day when I get up, I make my bed for two reasons. One, if I've had a hard day, I know that I'm always going to go back at the end of the day when I'm feeling tired to a nicely made, neat bed, right? And that gives me some pride. The second thing is I put effort into it. So I do a really good job of making my bed. And what tends to happen is that then like creates this momentum. It's like, right, and now I've new habit stack. So I've made my bed. Now I'll go and make a cup of coffee. And then when I have my coffee, I'll go and have a shower and make myself look presentable for the day. I'll take pride in that. And so, and gradually then that snowballs into the school run. And then when I finally get to my desk to do some work, I'm ready for work because I've just done things, you know, in a nice habitual, like just routine way. And I've done a really good job of it. I feel good. Right. And I don't think a lot of people discount the small stuff. It's the small stuff which makes the biggest difference.
Well, what I hear there when you talk about it, if you're not willing to be connected to and understand and do, if necessary, every piece of what it takes to find customers and create the value for customers, I would give them the same advice. Don't even bother with this, because how can you provide amazing value? Those that don't want to do it, I don't want to speculate on what their mindset is like, but it kind of falls into the camp of, I just can't be bothered. I just want to make a bunch of money. You know, why don't they just show up and say, I'm here for my entitlement. You know, give me my check as I go through. One of the things I love that you talk about is the difference between marketing assets and marketing activity. And I have some amazing examples that worked exactly the way you said that they would. But what's the difference between those two things?
Yeah, great question. So I kind of touched on it earlier on. So I think a lot of people see like the highlight reel on social media, especially with like the gurus that we see out there, like the Gary V's of this world, where, you know, they're always on social, right? But we have to remember that they've been doing it for like 30 plus years, this marketing like online thing now. And they've got a full team of people who are out there like doing videos and editing and posting on social and all of that stuff each and every day. And the challenge, like for most small business owners, though, they could be posting on, like spending 8 hours a day posting on social. And I've seen it happen. They don't get clients from it because they haven't learned to kind of like optimize it. I was listening to an interesting podcast, actually, by the chief marketing officer of Ryanair. It's a very controversial airline, actually, if for those who aren't familiar with it, based out of Ireland. They do everything on the cheap, basically. It's like budget airline. And then if you want, like at one point you had to pay £1 to go and use the toilet on the plane. It was like crazy, some of the schemes which they came up with to like eke money out of people. But what was interesting, he had a really valid point about marketing. He was like, I don't understand why people constantly create new content all of the time or feel the need to, he said. Basically, if they just analyze their content and then for every 10 post videos they put out, there'll probably be two that outperform all of the other videos. So why not just like put those, I can't remember what he called it, like the baggers or something like that, the 10 baggers, right? You lock those ones away and you keep reusing them. You don't just like decide that, oh, because I've already put it out, we won't use it. So next time you roll out 10 new videos, you take the two that did really well, and then you just create 8 new ones. And then out of those ones, you pick off the next one or two that then do really well. And next time we've only got to create 6 new ones. And eventually we build up this archive of like bangers, basically, where all of the content's really good because we've analyzed it. But I just see people sitting on social, like posting day in and day out. And then they call me and they're like, I need some help with my business. It's not growing and I'm doing all this work. And I'm like, well, so the idea is, marketing activity is this notion that we have to keep on like constantly feeding the machine, putting out content and things like that. That's marketing activity versus assets. A marketing asset is something which you, it takes a bit of time, energy or effort, maybe a bit of money to produce it once. But once we've produced it, we can then rinse and repeat, you know, multiple times. So a book, you know, I mentioned several books, you know, during our conversation, Lee, you know, a book is one of the best marketing assets out there. It might take 8 to 12 months to, you know, draft up a book and get it published. But then for, you know, a couple of pounds, you can get them printed off. And for £5, you can get them, you know, $6, $7, you can get them shipped anywhere in the world, right? I get requests for my book. I sent one to Mongolia. It didn't arrive, unfortunately, but somebody requested one in Mongolia. And it still boggles my brain that this world that we live in, there are so many opportunities. But the idea is that, you know, and there are other marketing assets, like this podcast, for example, is a marketing asset. Videos on YouTube are a marketing asset because it takes a bit of effort. You produce it once, but then it sits out there on the digital ether, the world online, and people can constantly search it, stream it, download it, read it, whatever it is, you know. And I learned this lesson. So I went and did a talk when, it's actually when the second book came out. And I was giving the books away at this talk. There was about 100 people there in the audience. And the woman who ran it, she was so sweet. She's in her 80s. She'd run this really successful business in London and moved out to the Cotswolds where I live. So you think proper like chocolate tin English countryside. That's where I live, rolling hills, right? So she moved out here to retire. She's in her 80s. She's running this networking meeting and I'm giving my books away. And she came up to me and she literally grabbed me by the hand and she was like, "Robin, why are you giving all these books away?" She said, if you sold each one of those books for £10, you would have made really good money today. And I said, "Yeah, but it's not about the money." I said, "If I charged for it, then I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 people out of the 100 would have actually bought one. Whereas this way, I can give them out to people. If they choose to read it tomorrow or use it for a coffee coaster, or maybe in 2 years, they pick it up and actually read it. I feel like I'm giving something back. And this is part of my marketing strategy." And then she kind of went, "Oh, okay. Yeah, that kind of sounds like it makes sense." Anyway, about 3 weeks later, all of a sudden my social media just goes mad on like a Sunday morning. So I'm just having my morning coffee, girls are running around and stuff. I'm getting all these messages on social and just stuff's pinging off on my phone and whatnot. And what had happened is a few weeks had passed and then people had been just, "Oh, it's Sunday morning." They'd had my book on their bedside cabinet for a few weeks. They picked it up. I've just realized what I was about to say here, Lee. I'm going to say it anyway. I couldn't have been in bed with 100 people at that particular point in time, right? That's weird. It would be weird if I was. But the fact I'd built this asset, people could pick the book up and read it, right? 30 people, 40 people all in one go. And that's what happened. They picked the book up. They were sharing selfies with the book on social. They were writing reviews on Amazon. They were sharing it with their friends and tagging them in on LinkedIn and things like that. You could have a viral post on social media, right? But without assets, people don't have anything to sort of share and speak about you. So at marketing assets are like, you know, even if you just had 2 or 3 things, if you did a podcast, a YouTube channel, and a book, you'll be light years. You'll be like in the top 1% of business owners out there.
Yeah. Right. I think about it as seeds planted that live in the wild that grow. And it, like to your point, it can take 1, 2, 3 years to go. And that's really working on my side. If we had more time, I could go into examples, but I think you're completely right. And this notion of how come these things don't happen to me? You look like an instant success. And I'm like, yeah, right. This is my, you know, 40 or 50 year overnight success. And most stories are at least 7 year overnight successes, you know, going through. But I like your point of let's coach and help everybody appropriately all the time. You know, I'll be speaking and somebody says, "Oh, you're not scouring up all these things you could to monetize it." Like, no, I'm giving this value to the world and it comes back to me literally 10 or more fold than it has ever come back to you with all of your ideas. So what's different about your strategy of getting everything you can along the way instead of just helping everybody and then being exposed to amazing opportunities in the world, which your strategy is clearly exposing you to more and more opportunities. And I'm practicing the same philosophy. And I think it's right. I think most people would benefit greatly by switching from, you know, what can I get strategy to create value in the world? And then it'll expose me strategy to things I can do or not do.
Yeah, it gives you that one-to-many approach. I think this is one area which I'm on a journey with, because, you know, as much as I want to get out there and help everybody, I do believe that like good solid business advice should be democratized. It shouldn't be available just because you've got loads of money and can afford to work with a coach. And I know that probably sounds like it's doing me and all of the amazing coaches in the world a little bit of a disservice, doing us out of jobs. But the way I look at it is if people can't afford to work with me, the least I can do is send them a copy of my book and hope that it helps them along their way. Same with podcast interviews. You can access amazing information now on things like, well, Spotify, for example. I think you can get 15 or 18 hours worth of free downloads now on audiobooks. You know, great business books that are on there from some of the most amazing like thought leaders on this planet. And it at least gives people the opportunity to start and get great advice without having to spend a ton of money. And that's massively important to me. I would love to be able to do what I do for free one day. I'd like to get into a position whereby, like you, one of my businesses, I've grown it and been able to sell it and had a good exit so that I can start to give more back. But this is all part of that process of building up that momentum and creating that impact so that one day, you know, I can do what I really want to do, which is to have an accelerator, which is free, essentially. But hey ho, for the time being.
Yeah. I mean, to your point though, it doesn't do a disservice to consultants that are out there really trying to help. And I think less than 10% actually really help, and the rest of them are just trying to get a check. And so they don't have a very good reputation for that reason. But I think the way you're helping, the way I'm helping, it exposes us to more of the right clients. So it's a competitive advantage to have us land on the kind of work that we want to do. So I think it's the right way, create value all the time in the world. And again, it exposes us to stuff that's better opportunities than if we're just going after sort of win-lose negotiations. Robin, we're about out of time. One of my favorite questions to ask is, from this discussion, what was your biggest takeaway?
My biggest takeaway, that's interesting, isn't it? So actually it was from where you were explaining about your business, where you're trying to, where you're helping those, business owners in the mastermind, those bigger businesses. So I've played in the weeds for a little, the weeds, that sounds awful, doesn't it? I've chosen to work with small business owners, grassroots business owners, because I can see the impact. With bigger corporates, I've kind of always seen, you know, I've worked with law firms and accountants, big ones in the past, where they've got 100, 200 plus employees. And you're kind of fighting against a board and things like that. One thing which you made me realize when you're explaining what you're doing with your mastermind was that actually some of these bigger businesses are headed up by really cool entrepreneurs who actually would be pretty awesome to work with and probably don't see themselves as being a corporate necessarily. So they kind of got that entrepreneur type vibe going on with their business and actually could be a potential client for Fearless, but I hadn't seen myself as that. I've always worked with very, you know, I've run small businesses myself and I've stayed in that sort of space. So you've opened up my eyes to some potential people that I might want to work with in the future.
That's great. They're just people trying to create more value. And you like to, if you're a cyclist, you want to improve constantly. It doesn't matter what level you're at. They're in the same space. And I don't see any difference when I work with people. My biggest takeaway is you're helping me think more deeply and more effectively around how to help folks that are launching into a business and even get the mindset of getting started around creating value. There's a number of things that I hadn't thought of. So thank you, you know, so much for that. And I hope we can stay in touch. If people listening here want to learn more about you, Robin, where would they go?
Yeah. So best shout is to jump onto LinkedIn, Robin Waite, and hopefully Lee, you'll share the links in there a bit later as well. And I have got a gift for everyone listening as well. I've mentioned the book, Take Your Shot. You talked about it earlier on as well, but I'll happily sign and ship copies of those wherever anybody is around the world. And those are available at fearless.biz/TYS for Take Your Shot. It's lowercase. I take a great deal of pride in signing those personally and then taking them down to Pauline at the post office. She's always really curious about where they're going to as well, which country they're going to. So it's quite good fun.
Okay, awesome. Well, I really enjoyed this discussion. Thank you so much for being here, Robin.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lee.
All right. And this has been the Show Your Value podcast, where we explore the art of value creation. If you got some value out of today's episode, please like and leave a review. And until next time, go forth and show your value to the world.